Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, third chapter, text number 10. Panchama Kapilo Nama Siddhesha Kala Bliputam Provacha Asuraye Brahmana Sankhyam Tatvagrama Vinirnayam Panchama Kapilo Nama Panchama Kapilo Nama Siddhesha Kala Viplutam Siddhesha Kala Viplutam Provachasure Sankhyam Provachasure Sankhyam Tatvagrama Vinirnayam Tatvagrama Vinirnayam Panchama Kapilo Nama Siddhesha Kala Viplutam Provachasure Sankhyam Tatvagrama Vinirnayam. Vaishnavis. Panchama, the fifth one. Kapila, Nama, of the name, Siddhesha, the foremost amongst the perfect, Kala, time, Viplutam, lost, Provacha, said, Asuraye, unto the Brahman named Asuri. Sankhyam, metaphysics. Tattvagrama, the sum total of the creative elements. Vinirnayam, exposition. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The fifth incarnation, named Lord Kapila, is foremost among perfected beings. He gave an exposition of the creative elements and metaphysics to Asuri Brahmana, for in course of time this knowledge had been lost. Purport. The sum total of the creative elements is 24 in all. Each and every one of them is explicitly explained in the system of Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya philosophy is generally called metaphysics by European scholars. The etymological meaning of Sankhya is that which explains very lucidly by analysis of the material elements. This was done for the first time by Lord Kapila, who is said herein to be the fifth in the line of incarnations. Om Ganata Madanda Shajananjana Shalakaya Chakshurna Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Upakadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So, this class is probably going to be on the short side because I'm kind of doing it on very short notice. So there was a bit of a change in schedule. So anyway, I'm going to do the best I can on it, but it's probably going to be short. So, and this purport is mentioned about, as Prabhupada says here, the Sankhya philosophy is generally called metaphysics by European scholars. So I looked up that word metaphysics, and it was the study of it's like a department of philosophy, and it's the study of the fundamental nature of things. Metaphysics seeks to answer two questions: what is there, and what is it like? Okay. Sometimes also metaphysics is understood as understanding what's beyond physics, and it's what's beyond the normal understanding of the laws of nature. It's taken like that too. Generally, that's the more common understanding of what metaphysics is than that formal definition that I gave, which I looked up on the internet, obviously. So that's there too. And so I had an interesting experience. I guess it was kind of like gave me some metaphysical insight over the last couple of days. I was down visiting my mother on Sunday, and so my son and his wife happened to pop. They came down as well. So we're sitting in the living room, and we're just talking, socializing like that. So at one point in the conversation, the subject of dogs came up. My son mentioned how his mother, my former wife, just got a 3-year-old German Shepherd. So I thought, oh, that's interesting, and then somebody was saying, oh, he's probably be a good guard dog. And my mother said, maybe he'd probably be a good guard dog, they're good for that. And then my son said, no, not this one, he's very quiet, he's very meek. And then my mother's caregiver has a dog whose name is Rolo, and he's just a little dog, but he's not quiet. He's always barking. So she said, well, not like Rolo, he's always barking. I said, well, maybe they make a good team, because he's not intimidating. He's just a teeny little dog. Even though he barks a lot, nobody's scared of him. Whereas a German Shepherd, people are, scared of German Shepherds. They stay away from German Shepherds. So anyway, so we just kept talking. And my mother is 94 years old, and her short-term memory is pretty bad. I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's even, if you try to have a conversation with her, you have to repeat things. She doesn't catch everything. You got to repeat it and, like that. But her long-term memory, amazingly enough, is really good. This is going back 6 months ago now, but I remember about 6 months ago, between 6 months and a year ago, I showed her a picture. I went out to the garage and I got out the photo albums. And I showed her a picture of her elementary school graduating class, that's going back for her. That's going back, 85 plus years. Okay? So I said, Mom, do you recognize anybody in the picture? And she says, oh, yeah. She goes, and she pointed to the girls. She said, that's so-and-so. And she gave the names of all her girlfriends, And she gave the name of the teacher. I said, what about the boys? And she said, oh, we didn't talk to the boys. You know, back in those days, the girls and the boys, you know, you didn't mix. So she knew the names of the girls and she knew the name of the teacher 85 years ago. But, you know, if you tell it now, if you tell her something, probably within minutes she can forget. You could tell her something and then the next minute she's forgotten it, okay? But that long-term memory was good. So the reason I mention that is this. So we're sitting in the course of the conversation, you know, we're talking about dogs, and my mother mentions that, oh, yeah, she said, yeah, I still remember. I remember when we had the house in Shenrock. Shenrock was like a suburb in Westchester County. It was like about a half hour, 45 minutes north of the Bronx. And I had an uncle who was a doctor. He had a summer house up there, Lear, Mayapack, Peekskill, and Archer knows those places. So she was saying, yeah, I remember when Uncle Lou had that summer house in Shenrock. She said it was the oddest thing. It was the most amazing thing. When he would come home about a half hour, 20 minutes and a half hour before he'd come home, you know, before his car would drive over Crest Drive and come down the hill, all the neighborhood dogs would congregate by the house, and they'd be there waiting, and they'd be barking. And this was like, she said, 15, 20 minutes, even like a half hour before he even come. And I said, oh, okay. And, you know, she just blurted that out, you know, and I thought, okay, that's interesting. And then she said it again, and she said it about three times. I don't think she wasn't really trying to make a point. It was just, that's my mom at this point. She said, it was a strong memory, and she said it, and she repeated it, and she repeated it. And then I thought, I was sitting there thinking, I said, well, you know what, that is pretty far out. How could they do that? Because he didn't come home every night the same time. He only came home on the weekends, and sometimes not even the same weekend evening. You know, sometimes he'd come home Friday, sometimes Thursday, sometimes Saturday, depending upon his work, you see? So it wasn't like they, you know, every day they came at the same time. They didn't. They came on the days when he was coming home. They didn't come. They didn't congregate there on the days when he wasn't coming home. And they came at the same time, like about a half hour before he was going to come. So I thought, well, how's that possible? I mean, what's the explanation for that? And then I thought, let me just type this into the, I Googled it, dogs who know when they're, and before I could even finish the sentence, it, boom, you know, it comes up, it, dogs who know when their owners are coming home. And then I clicked on that, and I found that there was this experiment with this dog, JT. It was a famous experiment. It was conducted by Rupert Sheldrake, who's a mainstream scientist, and he's kind of reasonably famous. And then as soon as I saw the name, I went, oh, wait a second. Yeah, I knew. I knew there was something. I'd heard about this before. I thought I read about it in Judah Carmer's book, Human Devolution. But when I looked in the index, I couldn't find any mention of it. Maybe I heard him talk about it in a seminar he gave or something like that. But the gist of the thing is this, that this scientist did an experiment with this dog, because this dog was observed by the parents of this lady. Her name was, the owner of the dog was Pam Smart. That was the lady's name, okay? She would go to work every day, and the dog would stay home, and the dog would sit. Her parents were both, they were all living together, and they were retired. So when she left for work, the dog would sit, literally, just sit there at the feet of her mother all day. And then a half hour before Pam would show up at the house, the dog would get up from his spot and go to the window. They had one of those big, what do they call them? Like a bay window, thank you. Big bay window. So a half hour before Pam would show up at the house, the dog would just get up and go over to the bay window and just, you know, sit there the whole time and expectingly wait for Pam to show up. So the parents had been noticing that for a long time. I think it was, they said, years. And they mentioned it to Pam, and she said, how could that be? You know, how could that happen? So they, you know, she got together. I don't know how it exactly happened, but they conducted some experiments to see what was going on. And that, so this scientist, he said, well, we have to really see if this is something out of the ordinary or just an ordinary explanation. So they they changed the time when she was coming home. They changed the vehicle. Again, sometimes she'd come home at 2 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and even Pam didn't know. You know, so the parents didn't know, and even she didn't know. She was told only like, okay, now we're going to go home, you know, when they conducted the experiment. So it wasn't like she was thinking about it all day long or anything like that. And sometimes she came back in a car, bicycle, train, and she walked. You name it, you know. she came by taxis. She came back by different modes of transportation. But what they experienced, and then, okay, and but the, what they experienced is each time, whenever she, about, you know, a half hour before she was showed up at the house, the dog made the move and goes over to the bay, you know, the bay window. So finally, the way they really clinched the, you know, the experiment is, okay, they set up, had two cameras. And one camera went with Pam, and the other camera stayed at the house with the dog. So when, and they, what they did was, at the moment Pam was told, okay, let's head home now, and she started making the move to go home, they, you know, they took the picture and everything, they started filming, and the time registered on the camera. Okay, you know, 5:07 and no seconds. And within 11 seconds, you know, then they simultaneously, the person was back at the house. Even the cameraman didn't know what was, you know, what time she was going to start coming home. So the, as soon as she started, the cameraman at home, and then they were doing was filming when the dog moved from the, you know, the grandma's or the mother's feet start to go to the bay window. So that was 5:07 and 11 seconds. So within 11 seconds of the time that Pam started home, this dog, as it was had done hundreds of times, moved away from the feet. So how do you explain that? It's pretty far out. I mean, the dog couldn't see Pam away. Sometimes she was as much as 22 kilometers away. She couldn't hear Pam. If she was smelling Pam, why all of a sudden at that second, that time she start moving to? I mean, the dog's supposed to have a strong sense of smell. Of course, it couldn't smell that far. But there's no normal explanation for it. It seemed like the best explanation for it. This somehow or another, this dog, ordinary dog, was exhibiting powers of mental telepathy. The dog could, you know, just like you could hear somebody's voice, the dog could hear or understand Pam's thoughts. When Pam made the decision, I'm coming home now, right at that time, the dog would move away from the, you know, her mother's feet and go to the bay window. So, anyway, the scientist, his conclusion was, well, it's not like, it's not prove anything, it doesn't prove it, but it seems like the best explanation for this is that somehow or another, this dog is exhibiting mental telepathy. He's, you know, there's some community of sympathy of thought there between him and the owner. Okay, so where am I going with this? The point, the reason I'm mentioning this is, at least this is the thought that came to my mind when I was, after I, you know, investigated this and became convinced myself, yeah, this is mental telepathy. Okay, so here's a dog, an ordinary animal. According to our understanding, dogs aren't even on the level of human beings. I mean, a human being is more developed than a dog, right? And what to speak of the supreme being, you know, supreme personality of God. So if an ordinary dog, and I don't know if this holds true for all dogs, but it seems to be, if my mother was correct in what she remembered, it seems like it's just more than that one dog. You know, maybe it's a phenomena that is common among all dogs, or at least a lot of dogs. If an ordinary dog can understand when its owner is coming home, right? We don't think that Krishna, the supreme personality of Godhead, can understand when a devotee is, you know, thinking about him and praying to him. It's just like, it's really kind of, wow. Yeah, of course. Of course. I mean, an ordinary dog is picking up that the master is coming home. So Krishna, the supreme personality of Godhead, is hearing the prayers. Actually, and then I immediately, you know, thought to myself, well, is there, what's the confirmation for this from, you know, Shastric confirmation? And of course, it's abundant. It's you know, it's like, it's unending practically. I mean, in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says that Krishna is aware of the psychic movements of all living entities. So right there, he's aware of the psychic movements of all living entities. He's aware. And then there's so many verses, like in the seventh chapter, there's that verse, Vedaham samatichani vartamanani charjana bhavishyani chabutani mam chavedana kastana mam chavedana kastana. So it says, Krishna says, I know everything that's happening in the happened in the past, everything that's happening at present, and all things that are yet to come. I know all living entities. I know all living entities. But me, no one knows. And it's, if you can understand that, how could anybody know Krishna, really. So anyway, and Savasha Chahamriti Sanavishta, there's so many verses. There's so many verses that, you know, which clearly indicate that, yeah, that Krishna has this ability, that he can understand what's going on in the minds of all living entities. And consequently, of course, he can understand when a living entity is praying to him for help, for, you know, for guidance, for direction, wanting to come to him. He can understand that. He can understand it. He's aware that that's going on. He is capable of responding, and he's inclined to respond. Now, as far as the capable of responding, once again, so many verses support that. Maya jakshena prakate suyate sacharacharam he tunanena kuntaya jagad bibadi partate. That, you know, Krishna is explaining in that verse how the whole material energy is working under his direction. So he's supreme controller, basically. You know, so he's aware of when devotees or people are praying to him. He's fully capable of responding, and he's inclined. He's inclined to respond. Once again, from Bhagavad Gita, Suridam Sarvabhutanam. He's the best friend of every living entity. And Krishna says in the ninth chapter about, he says, Samaham Sarvabhuteshu Name Dvestos Dinapriya Ye Bhajanti Tumam Bhakcha Mayite Teshu Chapiham. That I envy no one, I'm equal to everyone, I'm not partial to him, but one who renders service to me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am a friend to him. So Krishna is inclined to respond, you know, reciprocate. So which brings us to the question, if that's the case, then how come things aren't better than what they are? You know, as if you have a Supreme Personality of Godhead that's aware of, you know, that people are praying to him, who's fully capable of responding to those prayers, and who's who's inclined to do so, how come things are so messed up in the world today? You know, people, I mean, what to speak of people being happy and prosperous? It's like, you know, disasters and calamities happening one after another. So it's far from a, you know, a happy place. And like that, so how do we understand that? Well, I thought of an analogy that kind of helps me understand it. Imagine you have a situation in a family. Okay, you have a mother and a father and an offspring, a son or a daughter. And that son or daughter is involved with drugs and alcohol. You know, it's a problem with substance abuse. It's sort of like a bit of an alcoholic addiction to drugs. And that son or daughter is praying to the parents, please help me, please help me, you know, please help me, to be happy. I need some money for this, to get my drugs and to get my alcohol. Do you think the parents are going to help? They're not going to help. Do you think the parents want their son or daughter, let's say son, to be happy? Yeah. But do you think they're going to assist him in that, you know, giving him money to go out and buy more alcohol and buy more drugs? Definitely. I mean, probably not. I mean, unless they're really in bad shape themselves. No way they're going to do that. They want their son to be happy, but they're not going to, you know, help him try to become happy like that, because they know he's just like totally misunderstanding how to be happy. He's in illusion. So Krishna's situation is the same. See, Krishna wants us. Krishna wants to see us happy, but he's not going to facilitate our becoming happy in a misunderstanding of life. See, in other words, if we're trying to become happy in terms of the bodily concept of life, that, you know, thinking I'm this body, my happiness lies in gratifying these senses to the max, and I don't really care how I have to do that. I don't care if that involves exploiting the bodies of other living entities, nature, you know, the environment, whatever. It's, you know, it's not my problem, right? Just as long as I can gratify my senses to the max, that's what counts. That's what will make me happy. No, Krishna's not going to facilitate somebody who's in that, you know, that conception of life, which is 99.999% of the human population in the world today. See? So that's why, you know, Krishna's not responding, or God is not responding to the prayers. You know, when people are making prayers, please help us, you know, please help. Why should I help you? It's kind of like they're just turning their back on Krishna's program. This human form of life is actually, yesterday we heard in the purport, it says here, King Rishabhdev advised his sons, tapasya, or voluntary acceptance of penance for realization of the transcendence, and here it comes, is the only duty of the human being. the only duty of the human being. And that's the only real purpose of the human form of life, to perform tapasya, to realize the transcendence, to, you know, to revive, purify our consciousness and, you know, reestablish our eternal loving relationship with Krishna. That's the only duty of the human being. So why should Krishna assist those who are, like, you know, totally disregarding his purpose? His, you know, this is his whole purpose in setting up this material world and, you know, bringing us to the human form of life is so that we take perform tapasya so that we can, you know, get out of here and go back to the spiritual world. And people are just, in general, just turning it, totally disregarding that or totally ignorant of that. And he's supposed to help them, you know, facilitate their enjoyment. Well, it doesn't make any sense. So therefore, that's the explanation of why things are the way they are today in the world. I mentioned this before in a previous class, is that one paragraph in the 8th canto, 3rd chapter, text 19, where Prabhupada says, only Krishna can deliver us from this material existence. Indeed, he is always trying to do so. He's never lazy in this regard. Even before we offer our prayers to him, he incessantly tries to deliver us like that. His only aim is to deliver us from this material existence. So therefore, he's known as Bodhi Karunaya, unlimitedly merciful. But unlimitedly merciful in what? Unlimitedly merciful in delivering us from this miserable condition of material life and bringing us back home, back to Godhead. See? That's how Krishna is unlimitedly merciful. Krishna is not unlimitedly merciful in making sure that we all have a very pleasant experience here in this material world, despite the fact that we're totally disregarding, totally acting in defiance or in rebellion to what he wants, and he's supposed to make it nice and pleasant and happy, good experience for us here. No, he's not unlimitedly merciful in that regard. He's unlimitedly merciful in what he said, what Prabhupada says right there in that purport, and what Krishna himself says in the Bhagavad Gita. He's unlimitedly merciful in delivering us from this miserable condition of material life and bringing us back home, back to Godhead. And in order to do that, different steps have to be there. And initially, some of what people are going to have to experience is it's not going to seem like Krishna's very nice at all. Because Prabhupada says in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita says, unless one has a pessimistic outlook on material life, then one doesn't have any impetus to make advancement in spiritual life. You see? So that's kind of, unfortunately, that's the first installment of Krishna's mercy for a lot of people, that they're going to have things happen to them which will facilitate them developing a pessimistic outlook towards material life, because then they'll have some impetus to, you know, to make advancement in spiritual life, to inquire what's going on here. Why am I suffering? You know, why, despite the fact that I don't want, am I being forced to get old, sick, and die? Why are all these horrible things happening to myself, to Adiyatma, Gadibota, Gadidavi, to my friends, my family, you know, etc.? You know, you just start to, when things get bad enough, if you got a half a brain left in your head, you start thinking, well, what's going on here? You start thinking a little philosophically. So that's my understanding of why things are as messed up as they are in the world today, because Krishna's got to do that. You know, that's where they're at. That's what people, that's what they need. They need stuff, bad stuff like this to happen to them on an individual level, on a, you know, communal level, on an international level, so that they can develop a pessimistic outlook towards material life and start making some, you know, moving their thinking towards, well, what's looking at the spiritual dimension. You know, whereas for devotees, it doesn't necessarily have to happen that strongly, or maybe at all, depending upon the level of consciousness of that particular devotee. So, okay, I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? First hand up I saw was Bhakta Davis, yeah. So I managed to fill it in. I didn't think I had much to say. Yeah. We're waiting for the microphone.
Really amazing class, Prabhu. There was actually a question that someone asked me on book distribution last week, so thank you. My question just kind of has to deal with the tail end of the class. Sometimes, although these arrangements from material nature are supposed to develop a pessimistic outlook towards material life, I noticed that in the modern day, a lot of people, when these things come upon them, they actually develop a pessimistic outlook towards God, rather than towards material nature. What would be your response to that?
Yeah, they could start off like that. And they might be stubborn and continue it for this whole lifetime. But eventually they're going to have to come around to you know, to thinking differently, because that's not going to get him anywhere. You know, say you, if somebody decides to develop a pessimistic outlook towards God, okay, so, like, I've talked about this with Judah Karma, and he goes, well, okay, then that's what you got. You're in a situation where you got what you got. You're in this, you're suffering, it's horrible, the world doesn't make any sense, it seems like a pointless, meaningless existence, and you're just stuck. I mean, where's your path upwards? In other words, where's the hope? Where's the hope for anything getting better? It's like a dead end. If somebody wants to come to that conclusion, well, they're welcome to do that. They're free to do that. But I mean, it's not a very promising, positive kind of a conclusion to come to. I mean, I'm sure there's other criticisms of that way of thinking, but that's certainly one. That, what does that get you? You know, okay, you've decided there's no God. Okay, good for you. What's your benefit? How does that benefit you? You're free to do anything you want. I mean, like, for instance, take me personally. At 66 years old, okay, if I could do anything I wanted, it wouldn't make much difference. You know, you can't, well, you just enjoy material life unlimitedly. It's very limited what you can enjoy anyway. So anyway, I don't see it as a very kind of a advantageous sort of a decision. Archdeep Prabhu. Oh, no. Another kirtan? Yeah.
Yeah, you were talking about the dogs in the beginning of the class.
Yeah.
And we hear many times that the four propensities of animalistic propensities is eating, sleeping, mating, and defending.
Use the microphone.
Animalistic propensities are eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But you know, if you analyze an animal, it seems like they do more than that. Like they love each other. Sometimes they grow attachments for, you know, their human parents, like a dog loves his parent. So where does that come from? It doesn't seem like it's in line with eating, sleeping, mating, or defending.
That's a good question. No answer comes to my mind. So maybe Archer has got something he can help. No good answer anyway. So.
Hare Krishna. Thank you again for a nice class on short notice. The first thing I wanted to mention was about you saying that Krishna is not unlimited and merciful in other ways, just in this way of getting us back to God. But he's also unlimited and merciful on the material side. That's why there's so many bodies, so many situations. This is what people wanted. The problem is that we want God to give us right now, which doesn't necessarily happen. I want to be a millionaire right now. No, you may have to wait. Krishna can arrange for you to be a millionaire, maybe not even this lifetime, but it will come if you have a strong enough desire. And so we want things right now, and we want it with no complications, but that's not going to happen because you're living in a situation with all other living entities who don't necessarily agree with your desire for dominance and for prosperity. So they're going to cut you down. Or in a very simple way, you may want a Mercedes Benz, and Krishna may give it to you, but you're still stuck on the 405 with everybody else. It's not that because I'm driving a Mercedes, everybody moves out of my way and I get to go everywhere faster than everybody else. So you see the point. You get what you want, but you're still in this material morass. So you're not going to be enjoying as you thought you would. If I get the house, if I get the car, if I get the job, if I get to live in Bali or whatever, I'm going to be happy. But no, you're still in this material world, on this earth planet, with everybody else. The air still is bad practically wherever you go nowadays. So you're still in the same situation, no matter what you get materially. But Krishna does fulfill those desires. He gives you away. Yanti deva vritan devan. You can even go to the heavenly planets, he said. But ultimately, you should want to come to me. And that's the ultimate mercy. But if you just want to stay here and spin around, he'll give you that. That's what he's done anyway. That's why we're all in the situation that we're in now. We wanted it. Somebody wanted to eat meat without any restrictions. So Krishna said, okay, take the body of a tiger. You don't have to go shopping at, you know, Trader Joe's or whatever. Just chase down the meat, kill it, eat it. So everybody's getting what they wanted, but not necessarily when they want it, and in the circumstance where there are no repercussions. That you can't arrange. Krishna gives you what you want, but there are concomitant factors. And as far as Ananda Kirtan's question, how do they show their love? It's just like the human beings. If you're not God conscious, then you're on the animal platform, according to the Shastra. So your so-called love is being shown in an animalistic way. I love you, I want to exploit your body. I love you, I want to feed you abominable things. That's how I express my so-called love. So the animals also do that, yes. A lioness loves her cub, so she goes out and kills an animal and gives them the meat to eat. So what kind of love is that, you know? So if you, as a human being, do the same thing, express your love in terms of feeding your loved ones abominable foods and exploiting their bodies, then that's not really love. Mm-hmm. It's an animal propensity.
Okay. Anybody else? The gentleman out here.
Morning. Thank you for your class. I just want to add on to the question, the animalistic question. It still has soul traits, and the soul we are part and parcel of Krishna. So there's still love in, you know, within the soul. But my other comment was with the catastrophes and everything that's going on in the world. I guess everything that happens, we're aware that it's Krishna's plans and doings. But one thing that I came across very recently in the Bhagavad Gita, in one of the translations, is that when there's a complete irreligion in certain places or that's where there's going to be calamity and catastrophes. And the fact that I'm saying, oh, thank God that, you know, we do it. But they said that even if you chant, you know, Krishna's name, even in a negative aspect, but you're still doing it, you're still protected by Krishna. So people always ask, oh, God is so merciful, why these things happen? In a way, people have died, but we understand that the soul is eternal, nothing's going to happen. And truly, what it really does is it shakes us up. I've seen actually people like want to unite. You know, unity, something that hasn't happened way too long. But thankfully, we are here and with Krishna.
Thank you. It's a comment, in other words. Yeah, you have to understand Krishna's mercy from a multiple life perspective. In the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, text 11, and one in the purport, Prabhupada says, due to many, many millions of births in this material world, our minds are always covered by the dust of materialism. So we have many, many millions of births in this material world. So it's hard to understand Krishna's mercy when you're just thinking in terms of this one lifetime. You have to be thinking of how the soul is eternal and, you know, in a very multiple life reformation program. Okay, thank you very much. Guntarod Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Whatever the exact explanation is, has the ability to understand when its master is coming.